This is Zorba Pastor on Your Health. Tom Clark with Family Doc Zorba Pastor here to talk with you about what's new in healthy living, share some down-to-earth advice and great lifestyle tips to help you get the most out of life. Want to talk with Zorba? Here's the number to call, 1-800-462-7413. You know, along with your calls, always some interesting research to talk over. Zorba, tell us about what we have this time.
How soon or how late, if you change your health habits, will it make a difference? In other words, do late starters really live longer, or do you have to be young when you actually change your health habits?
Oh, a lot of us are saying we wish we would have started being healthy.
It's too late now.
We'll find out.
Right. We'll talk. Coulda, woulda, shoulda may not be the right way to think of. And alcohol affects more people than you think. One out of three Americans. What can we do about it?
Well, not one out of three Americans is an alcoholic.
In a lifetime, prevalence of alcohol problems affect nearly 33% of the population.
If we're not alcoholics, we may have been touched by alcoholism in our family.
We'll talk about it.
Coming up. And our recipe?
Ooh, it's a great one. It's a listener recipe. Eloise's fajita chicken salad.
Oh, from a listener. Looking forward to that one. And we have our medical myth buster for you, too. So don't go away. 1-800-462-7413 is our toll-free number. Zorba, let's welcome a listener now in Green Bay, Wisconsin. Hi.
Hi, how are you doing today? Thanks for taking my call.
Sure, we appreciate it, and we're well, thank you. How can we help you?
Well, you can help me by relieving my wife's stress. I donate blood and plasma and platelets, and a couple of weeks ago I went and donated to donate. They hooked me up, plugged me in, and after a couple of minutes they came and unplugged me and said my plasma was too thick.
Your plasma was too thick?
Yeah. And my wife is all upset saying I should go to the doctor, find out what's going on.
Worrying about your thick plasma.
Yeah.
Zorba?
Were you dehydrated on that particular day?
Not that I can think of.
Okay, so
I usually drink a lot of water before I go in to donate.
Right. Now, you've been donating for a long time, I take it, right?
Yeah.
For many, many years.
Yeah.
The reality is your wife is right. Now, sometimes I look at family discussions and I go, one side, another side, this side or that side. But the reality is I'm not sure what the blood bank is talking about when plasma is too thick. But there are chemicals that we can put, that we essentially produce within our body that can change the viscosity of plasma or serum.
And there could be a health concern?
Well, you bet. There could be a health concern because it can be a marker for other things that are going on, for things such as proteins that may actually be in the plasma that are causing it. In other words, thick plasma may mean lots of protein. Lots of protein can be a variety of things, something called multiple myeloma, which is actually a form of cancer that can produce certain proteins in the body, can actually be a marker and be a marker so that you can't get blood. So the reality is she's right. You need to go to your doc. You need to have blood tests. You have to say, hey, the plasma was too thick, and there are certain tests that you can do to make sure it's benign. A lot of times it's benign. You know, meaning that there's nothing serious there. It may just be hydration, but she is correct.
Really?
She is correct. Yes, shocking that your wife is correct, isn't it? Yes, every time my wife is correct, I'm shocked. And you know what? That happens, at least once a year.
Every time you're
at least once a year. In my house, it happens at least once a week.
Every time my wife is correct, I'm shocked, right? No. I'm shocked continuously about how she's correct about things versus others. But again, going back, having them check it again is a cheap way of doing it. And again, the second time, certainly, if it's still thick, then you should go and see your doc. There's no doubt about it.
Okay, because looking at, you know, the bag they collect everything in, it looked cloudy compared to, everybody else who was donating.
Yeah, well, cloudy often means fat. That's often what it means in that. But, you know, visually looking at the serum, you know, what do you do? Do you lie down there with a bunch of other people that are giving plasma?
Oh, yeah.
You know, does everybody look at everybody else's bag and say, well, what does my bag look like versus what does your bag look like? Is this a guy thing? Are they all guys or are they men? Is there a competition here between plasma donors?
Well, there is a certain competition between me and a friend to see who can get to 20-gallon sooner. So
I must tell you, that is good competition. We need more people like you. That's the kind of competition.
I think I'd want plasma privacy if I were done.
Plasma privacy.
Oh, no, man. Then you, could, then you couldn't share all the jokes.
Thanks for your call.
Thank you.
Sure. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
800-462-7413. 1-800-462-7413. To a listener now, Zorba, in Minneapolis, Minnesota. Hi.
Hi.
What's up?
I'm a 28-year-old female, and I have a problem. My fingers have arthritis kind of like symptoms when I am gardening or doing the dishes or lifting heavy objects, you know, especially repeatedly. If they get overused, they just hurt. Mm-hmm. And I'm wondering if there's anything I can do about it, short of just taking ibuprofen and whatnot.
Uh-huh. What happens when you take ibuprofen or over-the-counter Aleve?
It helps it a little bit.
Uh-huh. Okay. And this is going on for how long?
A couple years. I am a part-time gardener, and okay. In the past I've been a full-time gardener, so mm-hmm. They get a lot of use.
They get a lot of use, a lot of use. So is that what you do for a living, you garden for a living?
Over the past 5 years, I was doing it all summer, yes.
You say arthritis, like, say, have you been tested for arthritis?
No. I just know that people, women in my family have it, and it's the same kind of thing where it's just real sore, and, like, sometimes I even drop things if I pick something up and it's too heavy.
Mm-hmm. They get it at a young age or an older age?
No, at a much older, you know, like 50s.
Yeah, much older, 50s.
Old.
50s, I mean, really, you know, they're 50s, they're kind of right on death's door when they're in their...
Boy, I'm not looking forward to my
50s. That's right, yeah, you're not looking forward to your 50s, because you are past your 50s.
Wait,
exactly.
What are you talking about?
35 forever. No, 39, that was Jack Benny.
39.
Well, first of all, I'm not sure what form of arthritis you have. The most common arthritis is osteoarthritis, degenerative arthritis. Usually occurs at a later age. Certainly it can occur in your 30s and 40s. More often it occurs in your 50s and 60s. Mm-hmm. But one of the things I would do is I would strengthen the muscles in your hand, the interosseous muscles in your hands. They can actually be an issue.
How do you do that?
Well, you do that through, first of all, if you talk to a physical therapist or you go to a weight trainer, mm-hmm. you do it through these little things, you know, you can picture Tom is now squeezing with
like
his hands.
Balls you squeeze.
Right, those things that
and
you
have some like,
bodybuilders
like
plasticky,
have. Soft plasticky,
or you take clay and you do it because one of the issues you may have is simply overuse syndrome, where you're using your hands but you've never built up the muscles in your hands and your forearms. That's what I would do. I would do some weight training with your hands and your forearms and see if this would take away the pain and the discomfort, because it may not be from the joints. It may be from the muscles.
If I did icing or like a heat pack?
Sure. At the point, icing would work. Some people use things such as Bengay, which are called counter irritants. Some people ice. Some people use heat. You can actually buy packs that you put in with a gel in the freezer that fit on the hands and the wrists. They can be very, very useful when you have your pain. And you can go to a medical supply store. Just a sporting goods store will have it. But I would get to the bottom of it. And it's either a visit to your doc to, once again, check to see if you have arthritis or physical therapist to build up the muscles in your hands to try to keep it from happening in the first place.
Okay.
Thanks a lot for the call.
Thanks.
By the way, Zorba, those of us who remember that Jack Benny was always 39 are way over.
Are way over. That's right. I don't see Jack Benny on Nickelodeon. The jokes must not make it anymore.
Speaking of Jack Benny and 39, tell us about the topic as to when it's too late to start getting healthy.
Well, late bloomers can make a difference. That's really, an issue. You know, a lot of people say, well, you know, I've had these bad habits my whole life. It's not going to make a difference if I make a change now.
Yeah, I wish I would have started eating a lot of vegetables and fruit, but right now I'm whatever age.
I'm over the hill. It's not going to make. Or, you know, I'm over the hill now, and no matter what I do, it's not going to matter. Yeah. And frankly, this was an attitude that I thought died in the 60s. Back in the 60s, when you were 50 years of age, you stopped exercising because you knew you would be dead at 60 or 61 or 62, which was not an uncommon age for men to die. We've gained about 15 to 20 years of longevity in the last 50 years, and that makes a difference.
Well, talk about this study.
Well, this was a very interesting study. Started in the late 1980s. They looked at people between the ages of 45, roughly, and around 64, 65. So they looked at people in that age, and they tracked 16,000 people. So 16,000 people in the U.S. And they talked about what they should be eating, 5 to 7 servings of fruits and veggies a day, keep your weight down, you know, sort of stop smoking a little bit, do a little bit of exercise. And what they found out of these 16,000 people, okay, 16,000, they're roughly 1,000. That's not a great number, right? 1,000 out of 16,000.
Right.
Not a great number. But there were about 1,000 people who actually, if they were smoking, quit. If they were, this is in the 80s, if they were eating wrong, they started eating more fruits and vegetables. They lost weight to get into their normal range. They started taking up exercises of any sort that they found 30 minutes a day. And they reduced their risk of heart disease by nearly 40% within 4 years.
At what age did they start?
In their 45, roughly, to 60.
Okay.
That's roughly it. So they cut heart disease, death by heart disease, by 35 to 40%.
Even if you're 65.
You bet. What happened was they were making changes later in life, middle age, late middle age, early old age. You know, we use 65 because that's when people get on Medicare. But the reality is, in other words, they were middle aged people who were doing bad things. Well, they were engaged in health habits. Maybe they weren't doing bad things, bad health habits.
Yeah.
And the ones who made a change dropped their risk of heart attack by 40%. That's a lot.
It's a lot.
That's a huge amount within 4 years. So I think what this shows, and this is the real issue, which I've just been fascinated with. Some do, some don't. Some make a change in their health habits, some do not. It's very clear to this that this 1 out of 16 people in this particular study, not a lot, they made a change in their health habits. They live longer. That's what happened. And they were middle-aged people who had bad health habits up until their 40s, 50s, and 60s.
It's never too late.
Right. It's never too late to start.
800-462-7413. 1-800-462-7413. A listener now, Zorba, in Bloomington, Indiana. Hi.
Hello.
What's up?
Thanks for taking my call.
We appreciate it.
Oh, thanks. Well, actually, it's a two-part question about H. pylori and the use of antibiotics.
H. pylori. Zorba, what are we talking
about?
Well,
H. pylori is a bacterium that lives in the stomach that causes ulcers. And it turns out the person who actually discovered this, an Australian, got the Nobel Prize, it was either last year or the year before that. And he was a strange person. He believed, at the time he started this about 20 years ago, maybe it was 20, 25 years ago, everyone thought ulcers were caused by stress. Smoking, because those are factors that seem to be involved with ulcers.
I remember this.
What he did was he had found this unusual bacterium. He was a gastroenterologist in the stomach. He said, I wonder if this is doing it. And everyone said, no, how could it be infectious? He made a concoction of it and drank it. And had an ulcer.
Yeah.
And then he gave it to other people. This is an Australian. Lo and behold, they found out that they would develop ulcers from this. And lo and behold, now we know many ulcers are caused by this infection. Not all. A lot of ulcers are caused by ibuprofen and Aleve, but many ulcers are caused by this. But now, so what's your question?
Yeah.
Okay, so you've kind of answered it in a way. Earlier this year, I had intense abdominal pain, so much so that I had to go to an emergency room.
Well, that's not fun.
I thought I was going to die. But the thing is, then, so the doctor, I guess, correctly prescribed antibiotics for me for a week, but he gave me 3 different antibiotics.
Correct. That's right.
Twice a day, I take 3 different antibiotics.
Right.
Now, my concern is the following. I work at the health center of a, you know, pretty big university, so I'm concerned about what the so-called nosocomial infections that you could get or being around patients and so on and so forth. So my concern is, aren't these too many antibiotics to take? I mean, wouldn't I develop a tolerance to them?
That's a very reasonable question. That's a really good question. And nosocomial infection, for those people who are not in the healing professions, means infections that come from hospitals and other doctors and patients and so on. You know, the antibiotics, and they're not all antibiotics, but the 3 pills that you're taking that work for this particular infection that often have to be taken, you know, for 1 or 2 weeks, it's not a long course. You're not on the antibiotics for a long period of time. I don't think you're going to develop tolerance because of this. It's a short course of antibiotics. I don't think it's going to put you at risk for other types of infections.
Okay.
And the fact is, when we find it and we're looking in the stomach, we treat it because we know that it's there and you went in with pain. So you have to say, well, I didn't have an ulcer, but I've got this infection. If it were me, I would take the treatment.
Okay.
It's not, there's not an exactness to it, but if I found the infection, I would have it because I don't like stomach pain, even if they didn't find an ulcer, because by the time, you know, you went in with pain, and even if they didn't find an ulcer, man, I think the balance of evidence is go for it.
Okay.
That's
Thank
what I would
you
do.
So much.
You're
yeah,
welcome.
And good luck with it. We appreciate the call. 800-462-7413. A listener joins now, Zorba, from Estes Park, Colorado. Hi.
Hi, how are you?
Fine. How can we help you?
Well, I have kind of an odd thing. I'm one of those old people. I'm 54.
Oh, okay.
Oh, my. For the last couple of years, I've had problems with burning in my feet, and it's really more towards not in my toes, but just back a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
And at first, I thought it was just good old athlete's foot. I treated with for that, and it turns out it wasn't that. I had my yearly physical, and I spoke to my internist about it, mm-hmm. and he wasn't too interested in it. But the strange thing is I've lost my hair on my feet, and then the burning goes up in my legs, kind of posterior lateral,
Ooh.
And I've lost the hair there as well.
Uh-huh. Do you smoke cigarettes?
I do not.
Okay, you don't smoke
cigarettes.
Well, this
cigarettes. Is just, he's old, so
yeah,
that
yeah,
he's 54
old.
Years old, so this is happens when you get old, you get, you lose your hair on your feet. And
well, yeah, there are other things that can produce a loss of hair. Sometimes, something called peripheral vascular disease
yeah.
in your foot. History of diabetes at all?
No. But I was worked up for that, and I came out fine.
Okay, because that's an issue. A lot of people, I would say most of the people who have pain in their feet, unlike pain in other parts of their body, often are diabetics or they have a diabetic problem. Were you checked for other things such as a B12 deficiency, folic acid deficiency? Worked
I take
up?
B-complex daily.
Mm-hmm. Okay, you take it daily. This is going on for how long?
About 2 years. And it's worse at night.
Mm-hmm. The pain in your foot. Okay, I've got a couple of very
yeah.
specific suggestions. Foot pain, which is called peripheral neuropathy. There's a list of things. If you Google on the net, peripheral neuropathy,
uh-huh.
you have to spell it N-E-U-R-O-P-A-T-H-Y, peripheral neuropathy, can produce... lots of things can produce it, diabetes being the most common, certain vitamin deficiencies, and then other strange things such as poisoning of copper and other types of unusual things can produce this. And then there's a whole group of people called unknown. Now, some of those are caused by drugs that they're on. Some of them are actually caused by supplements that people take that may be contaminated. And right now, I worry a lot about supplements because they don't have to state where the supplements come from,
yeah.
and I'm worried about Chinese supplements, and it doesn't say when you look at the supplement where it was made, especially with the stuff that we've now found with the fact that antifreeze was placed in toothpaste because
yeah.
it was cheaper.
Yeah.
And that's a big issue. So I talk to your physician, and once again, Google it and look at some of those things. Bring it into your doctor and say, I've got this problem with pain in my foot. I want to be worked up, and I want to see what this is. Now, chances are you might be a quarter or a third where we don't know, but you want to make sure you don't have any of the other major diseases that can cause this besides diabetes. Other things such as hardening of the arteries that leads to heart disease and stroke can also cause this peripheral neuropathy.
Yeah, we appreciate the call. Thank you so much. We also appreciate Eloise McCluskey of Spokane, Washington, who sent in the recipe of the week, Zorba. This one looks like a good one.
Ooh, it looks absolutely fabulous. It's Eloise's fajita chicken salad.
That's coming up next. More of your calls, too. Some more research, our medical myth buster, all right here on Zorba Pastor on Your Health from PRI, Public Radio International. Tom Clark with Family Doc Zorba Pastor here on Zorba Pastor on Your Health. Recipe time, and then back to your calls at 800-462-7413. This time's recipe from Eloise McCluskey in Spokane, Washington. Eloise, hi.
Hi.
We really appreciate your sending what sounds like a delicious recipe in, Eloise's fajita chicken salad. How'd you come up with this one?
Well, I actually didn't. My good friend Dana came up with it. Well, she combined it somehow, and I had it at a wedding shower.
So this is actually Dana's. You stole this recipe from Dana.
It
should be Dana's fajita chicken.
No. Dana's not on the air, and she'll never know. Dana will never
know. She'll know. She listens, Eloise will brag about it to her.
She'll brag about it. That's right.
Well, I'm giving her credit now.
That's right.
Okay. Well, as we go along here, Eloise, jump in whenever you want. Okay.
Two chicken breasts grilled and sliced. Now, are these boneless, skinless chicken breasts or with boneless? In this chicken breast.
Okay, yeah. Two of them.
2 tablespoonfuls of soy sauce.
2 big T soy sauce.
Where do you get your soy sauce?
I get the big jug sort of from Costco.
Mm-hmm. That's a great idea.
Put it in little bottles. Uh-huh.
There is a difference in soy sauce taste. The worst, the ones that I do not like are the ones that you generally buy in grocery stores next to the prepackaged chop suey. And the reason is they're very, very salty. They're the worst. I can't remember if it's Chongqing, if that's the one that I've had. But you want to get a good soy sauce. Kikkoman happens to be the one that I love.
That's what this is, yeah.
1 clove of garlic minced.
A clove of garlic minced.
1 bunch dark green lettuce.
A bunch of dark green lettuce.
Dark green. So you don't use, you try to use a lettuce, you mean such as Boston lettuce or bib, or it doesn't matter what kind of.
Yeah, there's some leafy red-tipped whatever.
Yeah, the red-tipped lettuce are really nice.
Yeah.
And, you know, during this season when you can get some stuff out of the garden, that's the best.
Oh, yeah.
Does anybody like head lettuce anymore?
My mother, but she's not around. She hasn't been around for a long time.
That's not saying anymore.
Yeah, but that's I don't know if
I know my wife, when she gets a salad and it's head lettuce, she just
That's
true. I know, I do too.
That is true. I do the same. Yeah. 1 can of black beans drained and rinsed.
A can of black beans drained and rinsed.
Yeah, that's important. It's draining it and rinsing it that's important, don't you think?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Otherwise, there is the carbohydrate that is sort of slimy around the bean, which is okay when it's cooked. But when you're having it in this particular recipe, you want to get that carbohydrate away. 2 chopped tomatoes.
2 chopped tomatoes.
1/2 red onion sliced thin.
1/2 red onion sliced thin.
I like that. It adds color.
Yeah.
And I think the visual way things look is extremely important, extremely important.
Mm-hmm.
1 cob corn grilled optional. Tell me about this corn.
Well, while you're doing your chicken breast, you can just throw on a cob of corn.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And you can make that too if you want. And as far as all these ingredients go, if you want to put another 3 tomatoes, you just vary it according to your taste.
Right. You know, I think the world is divided into 2 groups of people. Those people who follow a recipe exactly and those people who like to change and improvise.
But
I don't get it. You take the corn off the cob into the salad. Is that it?
You cut it all off.
Yeah,
and it's grilled.
Yeah.
It has a grilled taste.
Yeah. Well,
you couldn't put corn out of a can on the grill.
Because it wouldn't. No, it'd be a little hard. It'd tend to fall through.
That would be it. I think I'll grill the corn, flop, and it goes all the way out. That would be unusual, but I don't think it would work.
Okay.
Okay, here's our dressing. 1/4 cup of white vinegar.
1/4 cup of white vinegar.
Or you could put other, if you want to health it up, you
bet.
Can put something good in there.
Apple cider vinegar, wine vinegar.
Yeah.
In our house, it's balsamic vinegar or dye. Yeah. That's what it is.
Okay.
It's balsamic vinegar or dye. But there's a color issue. You may want to use a light colored or a dark color because that'll make a difference in the way it looks.
I think that's what she was going for.
Right.
Yeah.
But I happen to like balsamic vinegar. 2 tablespoonfuls of honey.
2 big 2 honey. Now, do you want to talk about where you get cheap honey, Zorba?
I get cheap honey from people who give me honey. I have people who send me honey all the time. They must think I love honey. I do. I get it in the mail all the time.
Wonderful.
People mail you honey?
Yes, I did. I get honey about twice a season, 2 or 3 times
Go
a season.
Away.
People send me honey. Not because they want me to promote their honey. There are a lot of people who harvest honey who listen to public radio.
Oh, that's so neat.
That's it. We scale high.
Well, I'm on public radio. Why doesn't anybody send me honey?
Well, because you don't like tofu. That's the reason you don't like tofu. They assume you don't like honey.
All right.
A tablespoonful of olive oil.
Big tea olive oil.
Extra virgin if you want to have it. We have our favorite olive oil on our website. We talk about that. A clove of garlic minced.
Clove of garlic minced.
Quarter teaspoon of salt.
Quarter little tea salt.
And this is interesting, half a jalapeno chopped fine. So, so you like the hot end. You like to make it nice and with a little bit of bite in there.
And, you know, this jalapeno, she happened to quadruple her recipe, and she said, I only used one jalapeno for the whole recipe, but it was not very hot. She was, you know, doing it for women. She wasn't sure what their...
No, wait a second. Women don't like hot
women
stuff.
Like hot
I know. That's not true.
That's a man thing. Yeah.
Okay.
Okay, and then we've got four corn tortillas.
Four corn tortillas.
Okay, so let's make this. Marinate the chicken breasts in the soy sauce and minced garlic for up to an hour. And I take it you can leave it in overnight for
whichever way you like it.
And that's the issue. When I have a marinade, I make it at my convenience, which may be the night before, and then I don't bother.
Yes.
Grill it until it's done. Follow the instructions. When you grill it, like we said, turn the grill on high. I measure all my chicken breasts with a quick thermometer to 160 degrees. Therefore, you will not have salmonella. So that's what I do. I don't just do it by look. You can do it by look and make sure the pink is gone. Thermometer is the best way because once it reaches 160, you're done, and you don't have to worry about grilling it longer, and therefore it will not be as dried out. Then in a bowl, combine white vinegar, honey, olive oil, garlic, salt, the jalapeno, and mix. Now, to serve, preheat the oven to 400 degrees, cut the corn tortillas into 1/2-inch strips, lay on a cookie sheet, spray it with cookie spray, and then bake it for 7 minutes until browned. Lay it on a bed of lettuce.
Yeah, you arrange the lettuce on these plates.
On these plates,
on your plates, yes. And then you go from there. You build it. You put little beans, little tomato, little onion, the corn. You sprinkle it all on top of plates that you are sort of arranging.
I feel so good about this. I'm ready to eat this. Add 3 or 4 pieces of chicken on the top. Drizzle the salad dressing and top with the toasted tortillas. It sounds luscious.
It looks good.
It sounds very good. When we did our calorie analysis, each serving was only 286 calories. When we look at protein, it's a whopping 30% of the protein you need for the day. And that's because boneless, skinless chicken breast is a major source of protein without being a major source of fat. It's only 7% of the daily amount of fat that you need. It's only 4 grams of fat. This is a dynamite, healthy way to eat chicken. It's a great recipe.
Eloise, it just sounds so delicious. Thank you so much.
If you wanted to put avocado on that, you'd sprinkle that on top of that.
It's fabulous. Fabulous. Thank you so much.
You are welcome.
For sharing this with us.
And for sending us this winning recipe, Eloise gets a free copy of our cookbook, Heart Healthy, Low Fat, Guilt Free, and Tasty Recipes from the Kitchen of Zorba Pastor. And if you want to enter our recipe contest, it is easy. Just email your original or borrowed from a friend low-fat recipe to us at
zorba@wpr.org.
I was going to take a stab at that,
You can't say that. It's me.
Oh, I can't remember
it's
it.
It's me.
And you can.
zorba@wpr.org.
For today's recipe, send a stamp self-addressed business-sized envelope to, I do remember this address, Zorba Pastor on Your Health, 821 University Avenue, Madison, Wisconsin, 53706. And if you want this recipe to go, just go to our website. You can sign up for our weekly recipe podcast and search all of your favorite Zorba Pastor on Your Health recipes. That's at
zorbapastor.org.
800-462-7413 is our toll-free number. 1-800-462-7413. Zorba, we have a listener now in Savannah, Georgia. Hi.
Hello.
How can we help you?
Well, I have a son that is a soccer player.
Mm-hmm.
And I've heard varying reports about whether it's better during a game for them to drink water better than drinking something like, you know, Powerade, Gatorade, one of those products.
Mm-hmm.
And so I've wondered about that, and I'd like to know what you think about that.
Yeah, that is, that's an interesting question. We've talked about this from time to time, and what to drink and when to drink it, before or during or how.
Right. It's a, you know, it's an issue. We have become sort of water fanatics in America, you know, where we have water with us all the time. The real issue that's important with kids on a soccer field is to replace the water. That's the most important issue. Replacing the salt, very secondary. Replacing the potassium, also secondary. The thing about kids that we have to be careful with is they tend to get too many calories, which is why so many of our children are obese. They've doubled and tripled the obesity rates, depending on which age you look at, over the last 25 years, and that's because they drink sugary things.
Does this mean that the water is better than the energy drinks?
Well, the energy drinks are really not essential. They're not. Now, let me tell you what they do have.
Yeah.
The energy drinks will tend to have potassium, but the reality is most children, if they eat properly, are not deficient in potassium, and they don't lose it on the field. So I think it's far better, and there's good evidence that it's far better for kids to simply drink water and replenish the water that they have, because they dehydrate. Yeah. There's no doubt about that.
So it's like when they get thirsty.
And forgo the energy drinks. Absolutely. The energy drinks, there's no evidence that that gives them energy. Now, carbohydrate loading the night before in order to get enough glycogen in your liver, that's an issue. Oh. So they often eat pasta so that they can get glycogen in their liver so they can use that energy. That's a totally different issue, because what happens is our body says, hey, I need quick energy. It sends a signal to the liver that then essentially pushes glucose into the body, that stuff that's absorbed right away. But when you're drinking Gatorade right now in the field, the sugar that's in the Gatorade doesn't tend to get really into your bloodstream. Probably for about 15 minutes. The water is much better. So I think water is the way to go.
I appreciate the that opinion.
And we appreciate the call. Thank you very much for calling. 800-462-7413. 1-800-462-7413. And a Winchester, Kentucky caller now. Hi.
Hello. How are you?
Fine. How can we help you?
Well, I have a question about a vegetarian diet. I'm trying to mostly go vegetarian, not entirely, eating meat twice a week, usually chicken or fish. Mm-hmm. And my question is this, about protein, how much do we need? And is soy a safe thing to eat? Because I'm hearing two separate things when I read or hear stuff about soy. And it being healthy or not healthy for us.
Two separate things. Yeah, well, what are the two separate things?
She said we help some healthy and some not healthy. Here's a third. Yeah. It doesn't taste good.
Well, you would be surprised how much soy is in products that you and I may be eating, prepared products. But let's talk about vegetable protein. Vegetable proteins are, and they used to be termed all the time, incomplete proteins, because they didn't have all the amino acids. Mm-hmm. And then many years ago, a woman came out with a book called Diet for a Small Planet. And what she found was that when she did an analysis, that when you combined traditional vegetable products such as rice and beans, that you often had a complete protein, because what the beans lacked, the rice had, and we're talking about whole grain rice, mm-hmm. what the rice had, the beans had.
Uh-huh.
And essentially, when you look back at diets and what people were eating, because animal protein is an expensive protein in a society, you found out that people often combined vegetable proteins to make so they would have all the amino acids in their body at one time. So we know now that vegetarians and vegans are vegetarians who don't eat any animal products, so no milk, no cheese, no eggs, so they're not mm-hmm. getting any animal protein at all, really do quite well and can have a life that is excellent, that is super, that actually has less cardiovascular disease than the traditional American diet. And part of that often is soy. Soy is a high protein vegetable. It's a bean rather, which obviously is very important. And I don't see anything wrong with soy. Not at all.
Okay.
And I don't think it's how you do it. Now, there was a study that came out of Hawaii that questioned whether or not people who ate tofu had holes in their brain.
What?
Yeah, that's the way it was hyped on the media. Yeah. Eat tofu, get holes in your brain. Because they looked at brain weight and MR scans, and it was rather interesting. And what was interesting about it was that they didn't have holes in their brain at all. They didn't function differently. It was an odd study that never was reproduced. So I think you can eat all the soy you want to.
Okay.
You'll do fine. I have to remember, I remember when I was cleaning Indiana office. We moved from one office to another in the late 80s, early 90s, and I was cleaning out a bunch of dietary advice, and I found dietary advice in the 50s, and I wish I had saved it. I didn't save it. I threw it out the brochure, and it was the right way to eat for the ill patient. That was the title of it. And you looked at the picture on the front cover, and it had sausage, bacon, cheese, ham, pork, beef. And you looked off on the side. The vegetables were off to the side.
Yeah.
And the centerpiece was all this animal protein. And it was the right way to eat for the sick patient. And I thought, oh, wow. You know, this basically produced illness. And they had no concept in the 50s that essentially that we were eating the wrong way.
I was raised that way, too. Yeah.
Absolutely. The reality is the more vegetarian diet we have, the better off we are.
Thank you so much.
Sure. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Let's grab a quick tip now, Zorba, from the Zorba Pastor on Your Health inbox. This one from Winona in Aiken, South Carolina, who writes, I started listening to your show online a few weeks ago and really enjoy your great advice and sense of humor. One of your listeners was having trouble with his oatmeal at work and worrying about the kind of nutritional benefits of the instant kind. Remember that?
Yes, I do.
Winona has a suggestion. Listen to this. This sounds good. Many Europeans soak raw oatmeal and fruit overnight in milk or yogurt. The Swiss call it M-U-E-S-L-I, muesli.
Yeah, muesli, right.
You know muesli?
Of course. You don't know muesli?
No, I didn't even know how to pronounce it, obviously. The soaking softens it, so no cooking is needed. It's usually eaten cold and is very healthy. You can prepare it the night before and take it to work with you in the morning. This sounds kind of okay.
No, it really does sound okay. You know, I've heard of muesli, and there are cereals called Mucilex that are a variation of it, a high-fiber cereal.
Mm-hmm.
But I've got to try that. I never really thought about
fruit
it.
Fruit and
it
in milk or
and
yogurt.
You can keep it in the refrigerator. Sounds great to me.
Yeah, me too.
Well, thanks. Thanks a lot for sending
that. And as a bonus, Winona has sent us her favorite recipe to prepare, and we're going to post it on our website.
Which is at zorbapastor.org.
And you can always let us know your thoughts by sending us an email to
zorba@wpr.org.
Well, we have lots more of your calls coming, some interesting research. Our medical mythbuster is yet to come here on Zorba Pastor on Your Health from PRI, Public Radio International. Tom Clark with Family Doc Zorba Pastor here on Zorba Pastor on Your Health. Before we get back to the phone, Zorba, we mentioned at the outset research showing that there are alcohol problems in 1 out of 3 Americans. I suspected that this was in the family of 1 out of 3, but this is apparently affecting alcoholism affecting 1 out of 3 of us.
Well, alcohol affecting 1 out of 3 people in America sometime in their lifetime, not alcoholism. So let's differentiate that.
Okay.
I mean, alcoholism is dependency. So, you know, when you drink, you have to drink until you're drunk, essentially. And an alcoholic is somebody who is, you know, powerless over alcohol. And there's certain criteria to that. But the issue is, at some point or another, it appears that a number of people have been essentially themselves had issues with alcohol abuse. And we look at it, and dependency is different. Somewhere around, according to this study, big study, 43,000 adults questioned for a bunch of health habits sometime in their life, nearly 18% said that they had abused alcohol at one time or another. And roughly about 12%, that's a lot, 12% said they were alcohol dependent. That's what we would call alcoholism. That's a lot of people who are alcohol dependent, and a lot of people then who've said they've abused
it. Are we talking about at some point in one's life having too many drinks and getting drunk?
Well, not one day, but at some point in one life saying, yes, you know, for a couple of years in college or for 6 months, I got drunk every Friday and Saturday night. Right. That's alcohol. That's where they had abused alcohol. But 12.5% saying I was dependent on it. I had to get drunk every Friday or Saturday night. In one case, they said, well, I did it, but I stopped for a few days. Then I went on and did it, you know.
Those are large numbers.
They're very, very large numbers. Now, the issue that's important here is a few things. Alcohol is a funny kind of a drug. It's a drug that's acceptable in society versus illicit drugs. You know, you have people say, well, you know, adults don't get stoned, you know, when they're smoking marijuana. They don't want to admit. They don't go around admitting getting stoned, but they may have five drinks on a Saturday night. So it's much more acceptable than illicit drugs. But it's a marker for other issues. Panic disorder, social phobia, anxiety, depression. And a lot of those people are using alcohol essentially for these problems and don't necessarily seek psychiatric help because that's not acceptable.
And society is not really doing much of anything about
it. No, and that, you know, the other issue is we're not doing much about it. So we're not saying, hey, you're getting drunk on Friday and Saturday night. You're in your 20s. Do you have any other issues? Let's talk about them. So as a parent, if you find your child is getting drunk on Friday and Saturday night, or just as a friend, as a buddy, if you find that person is getting drunk on Friday or Saturday night, this shows it's something you should talk to them about because it's much more prevalent than anyone thought. That at some time in their lives, one out of three Americans have been touched by alcohol. That means they've been touched by other problems, too.
1-800-462-7413 is our toll-free number. And Zorba, our next caller is in Madison, Wisconsin. Hi.
Hi.
How are you?
I'm great. How are you?
Fine. And how can we help you?
I was calling with some questions about natural remedies, if they exist, for fertility. I have been trying, my husband and I have been trying to get pregnant for about 9 months. It's our, would be our second child.
Mm-hmm.
And we're using the fertility awareness method. And I've been coming across in the last couple months as I've started looking a little deeper.
What's a fertility awareness method?
Oh, that's the tracking fertility indicators using basal body temperature
in
the morning.
Right, okay.
Okay, and also checking cervical mucus. And one of the things that I keep coming across as I'm looking for natural remedies are ways to improve, mostly ways to improve cervical mucus quality.
Right, and that's, by the way, that's from the natural point of view of fertility, that's always been the big issue. Basal body temperature is where a woman checks her temperature. Mm-hmm. You can use a special thermometer that basically measures, it's just easier to measure the basal body temperature. And you check your temperature every single morning, looking at your temperature. And when your temperature has risen, that means generally the egg has already popped.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
And the goal is to find out where their timing is so that you can have sex prior to that time, because it turns out that having sex after the egg has popped, you're not as likely to get to fertilize that egg as if you had sex prior. Mm-hmm. You know, the sperm are essentially up there prior to the egg actually occurring. So that's the goal behind that. And cervical mucus is a mucus that changes once again at about the same time. These are hormonally regulated. The mucus actually essentially becoming different, stringier, so that the sperm are more likely to be able to get up there and fertilize that little egg.
Now she's looking for natural fertility help.
So what have you read about?
One of the things, well, there are four things I keep coming across with regards to cervical mucus, the quality and quantity. And these four things that I keep reading about are baby carrots, pineapple juice, evening primrose oil, and flaxseed oil, in terms of natural remedies.
Sure. All of those things, you know, there's not a lot of science here, but all those things may affect cervical mucus. Once again, we don't know. None of them, of course, cause any harm to try and get pregnant or a baby, and these things may have some effect or may not. I'll tell you, fertility is a... As much as we know about fertility, that's as much as we don't know about fertility. And there's a landmark study that occurred many, many years ago that showed that people who tried to get pregnant and couldn't get pregnant but were continuing to have sexual relations, often had some period of time over a 2 or 3 year period where everything was just right and they got pregnant. In other words, of those who couldn't get pregnant, if you followed them, there often there still was a pregnancy that may have occurred at year two or year three. And we don't know what these things are. We don't know if they're food-related, temperature-related, exercise-related, good health-related, sexual position-related. There are things that we don't understand that fall into this unknown range. So I would try all of those. Whether any of them work, I don't know.
That's a huge relief to someone who's been trying for 9 months.
It's not a long time on that on the fertility a lifetime schedule, but I know how anxiety provoking that can be because of that. Now we had four children. We had our last child got pregnant when my wife was 40. That's when we had our last child. We had our first child when she was 32 is when she had when we had our first child. So.
As did I. Well, thank you. That's good to hear.
Good luck to you.
Thanks a lot for the call. And our medical mythbuster links to that last call, so let's get to it. Today's myth deals with the thought that you can influence the sex of your child by sexual position or timing. Can parents determine whether they're going to have a boy or a girl?
Based on sexual position and timing? And the answer is no. That's very interesting. For years, there was a method, I think it was called the Shettles method, something like that, especially in the 60s, that if you had intercourse close to ovulation, that made a difference. Missionary position, you were more likely to have a boy, missionary position actually was more likely to have a girl.
Supposedly.
Was it a boy or a girl? I'd go back and forth. You know, one position was a boy, one position was a girl. And then Johns Hopkins looked at all the studies and found that it did absolutely not work. And they looked for, especially men and women who were engaged in natural family planning, which was timing of intercourse. And the idea was that the X chromosome, essentially the sperm that had the X chromosome would swim differently than the sperm that would have the Y chromosome. And it turned out not to be the case at all. And there was an article in the New England Journal of Medicine. They looked at more than 200 women who were planning on getting pregnant to find out whether or not timing made a difference. And the answer was no. So position, timing, doesn't make a difference. As far as we know, it's chance.
How about anything else? Diet?
No. Go ahead.
There's no other thing.
Position, where the moon is, whether or not you eat Limburger cheese, whether you have a little milk at night, whether you use a pillow underneath the woman's pelvis before you have sex, whether or not the man is on top, woman's on the bottom, you're on your side. None of that seems to make
any
difference.
It's all kind of a toss of the coin.
It's a boy or a girl. That's what it is. It's a boy or a girl. Good luck, we say. Good luck.
Do you have a myth for Zorba? We'll try to bust it or prove it right. Just send it along in an email to
Zorba@WPR.org.
Now, Zorba, let's see if we can help a listener in Edwardsville, Illinois. Hi.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure. What's up?
Well, I've got a question for Zorba, and it has to do with an injury that I had. And I have an apparent partial tear of the anterior acetabular labrum in my right hip. And I have been to a sports medicine doctor and was sent to get an MRI and then was referred to a specialist, an orthopedic surgeon in St. Louis, who's one of the best specialists for that particular kind of tear. Who's referred me to a physiatrist, and I've also been referred to physical therapy, and I'm going through, a whole round of things trying to avoid surgery. But I have a question that with a partial tear, knowing that the labrum is cartilage and the fibrous cartilage, is it possible that can repair itself? Can that mend itself? Can scar tissue grow over that so that it eliminates the need for surgery, or does it seem inevitable that surgery is the end result?
The reality is, when we look at these, they don't repair, but some people the pain goes away. You know, cartilage often in a situation like this, if it's a complete tear, you need surgery to fix it. On the other hand, when we're looking at MR scans of that area, we have to look at it and we have to say, well, person doesn't want to have surgery if they don't need it. Let's give a trial of rehabilitation and therapy and see if the pain goes away. That's the issue. The issue isn't the tear. The issue is the pain. What I would do if I had a situation like this is I would give it a trial of physical therapy. Going to a physiatrist is great. I'd give it, as long as I was willing to tolerate it, which for me would probably be 6 months. Mm-hmm. And at the end of 6 months, if I still had pain, I would have surgery. That's what I would do. They can often do it through a scope. They can repair it, and the recovery is usually quite good, and you don't know until you go in there how bad it is.
Yeah. Well, I have another question, too, because I actually discovered that I have a friend that I went to college with who's a dance partner of mine that is a physiatrist in Dallas, Texas, and she had told me that she oftentimes recommends the glucosamine with chondroitin sulfate.
Yeah, that may work, but the reality is the data on glucosamine and chondroitin sulfate, for the most part, is very minimal, and it works for pain. I don't think there's any evidence that it actually works for healing. There's evidence for some people that it works for pain. So thank you very much for your call.
Okay, thank you.
Yep, thanks a lot. Time now, Zorba, for Judge Zorba here on Zorba Pastor on Your Health.
Ooh, Judge Zorba.
Today's case deals with Q-tips, and this is an important case, and comes to us from prosecutor Paula in Brooklyn, New York.
Okay.
The defendant in this case is her fiancé.
Okay.
She writes, "My fiancé uses a Q-tip every day after he showers. I've heard that it's safer and better to use a Q-tip every couple of days."
The reality is you don't want to put stuff in your ears because you're more likely, if you have wax, to push it into the ear.
So not once a day, not once every other day.
No, there's no reason to. I mean, there's no reason to put a Q-tip into your ear ever. You know, if you want to dry out your ear, first of all, you can let your ear just dry out naturally. But if not, you put a soft, clear, terry cloth, towel into your ear to wick out the moisture. And if you want to do it, you can also take some cotton ball or something like that and put it in there. But Q-tips, I'm pretty much against them. I mean, I think they cause more problems than they're worth. So neither one is correct. That's what Judge Zorba says for this particular thing. And I like it. I'm now a judge. I'm a judge. Judge Zorba. I like it. I like the new title. I'm going to stick with it.
I like the decision, too. Bang. You're both guilty.
That's right. That's right. That's right. Send them, folks. I can be the judge.
If you have a health or lifestyle debate you'd like Zorba to verdict on, give us a call or send us an email to
Zorba@WPR.org.
Zorba, see you next week.
A pleasure to be here, Tom.
For all things Zorba, including our recipe podcast, visit us on the web
at ZorbaPastor.org.
And don't forget, you can bug our producer anytime at 800-462-7413. Zorba Pastor on Your Health is a production of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's produced by Adam Friedrich. Our executive producer is Charles Monroe Kane. Brad Kohlberg is our technical director. And Gigi Holland fills your recipe requests. Our theme music is by Leo and Ben Sidran. For Zorba Pastor, I'm Tom Clark, expecting your company on the next Zorba Pastor on Your Health.
Copies of today's show are available through the radio store at 800-747-7444. Ask for program number 0721Z. More on healthy living, including heart-healthy recipes, podcasts, show archives, and listener feedback, is available online at ZorbaPastor.org. That's ZorbaPastor.org.
PRI, Public Radio International.